listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today we take a look at something that occurs every day at the United Nations in New York, and that generally escapes the attention of the American media. A press briefing by the spokesperson for the Secretary General, Stefan Dujarric, reviewing the work of the UN around the world and taking questions from the press. Among the topics discussed Thursday were countries from Afghanistan to Yemen and subjects that included border incidents, ceasefires, political affairs, natural disasters, and violence. This is the spokesperson for the Secretary General of the United Nations, Stefan Dujarric, in New York at the United Nations headquarters Thursday.
How's everybody today? Good? Excellent. All right. Good afternoon. The Secretary General will be traveling to Canada this Saturday, 9th of June, to attend the summit of the G7 in Charlevoix in Quebec. He will be participating in the outreach session of the G7, and that session is entitled Healthy, Productive, Resilient Oceans and Seas, Coasts and Communities. And he will be attending that session along with the leaders of the G7 and several other countries, as well as heads of international organizations. He will also hold a bilateral meeting with Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, on the sidelines of the meeting, as well as other heads of state and government also present at the G7. And the Secretary General will be back in New York that day and be back here the evening of the 7th. I have a senior personnel appointment. The Secretary General has announced the appointment of Shireen Dodson of the United States as the new United Nations Ombudsman. She will succeed John Barkat, to whom the Secretary General is grateful for his commitment and dedicated service to the organization. The Secretary General also wishes to extend his appreciations to James Lee, who is currently serving as the acting UN Ombudsman. Ms. Dotson brings to the position over 30 years of diverse leadership experience in business, government, and nonprofit organizations. She's currently the Ombudsman of the U.S. State Department, a position she assumed in 2010. And the Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, Rosemary DiCarlo, today visited Mogadishu in Somalia, where she held a series of meetings with senior government officials to reiterate the UN's support to the people and federal government of Somalia. She was accompanied by the Secretary General Special Representative for that country, Michael Keating. Ms. DiCarlo said that Somalia is at a critical juncture and stressed that the unity of Somalis is essential to advance federalism, reduce violence, defeat extremism, and tackle the humanitarian challenges and deliver real benefits to the population. Also today, the UN and its partners, including the African Union and the European Union, welcomed the outcomes of this week's National Security Council meeting held in Baidoa, the capital of Southwest State in Somalia. During the meeting, the federal government the federal government, federal member states, and Benadir region and various ministries reached key agreements on the transition plan, revenue sharing, and the electoral model for the 2020 elections. And our humanitarian colleagues in the Central African Republic tell us that amid renewed fighting, at least 9 humanitarian compounds have been looted since May in the Central African Republic's second largest city of Bambari, prompting many NGOs to temporarily suspend or curtail assistance to an already struggling civilian population. Bambari has more than 37,000 internally displaced people living in 9 sites. They rely on humanitarian support for health care, nutritional support for children suffering from acute or severe malnutrition, food rations, and psychosocial support for survivors of gender-based violence. The resurgence of violence in Bambari comes at a time when the humanitarian community is making every level to raise the funding for the humanitarian response plan. In the first half of 2018, only $85.5 million, or 17% of the $515 million urgently needed to help 1.9 million people in need, has been received. And from Afghanistan, the UN mission in Afghanistan today welcomed the announcement by the government for a temporary ceasefire with the Taliban. The UN commends the stated preparedness of the Afghan authorities to initiate in good faith any steps towards formal peace process. And that was a statement from the Secretary General Special Representative Tadamichi Yamamoto. The ceasefire follows the Afghan government's call for unconditional peace talks with the Taliban at the Kabul Process 2 conference that was held in Afghan capital in February. And the special envoy for Syria, Staffan de Mistura, just concluded consultations on the Syrian political process. Those discussions took place in Istanbul earlier today, and while there he met with Turkish authorities as well as officials from the Syrian National Coalition and the Syrian Opposition Coalition. The envoy is planning to continue his regional consultations in the coming days. And from the Congo, a couple of updates on Ebola. Distribution of World Food Program rations have begun in the DRC's Ebola-hit Equateur province. This is part of an effort to support those...
In this video, we will be discussing how to troubleshoot
dining... I can't turn the damn thing...
There we go.
Okay.
All right. In this video, we're going to learn about the World Food Program's ration distribution. Maybe you want to take the computer outside, Evelyn. Evelyn, maybe just take the computer out.
There are 3 mechanisms.
I'm trying to turn the whole computer on.
Okay.
All right. Back to you.
Let's try it one more time. All right. Let's try it again. The World Food Program's rations have begun being distributed in Equateur province, which has been hard hit by Ebola. This is part of an effort to support those directly affected by the latest outbreak of the deadly virus and limit risky population movements. Families of Ebola patients discharged from treatment centers and of those who have had contact with them or suspected victims are receiving up to 3 months' supplies of cereal and beans. A projected 1,000 people are to be immediately assisted. And also on Ebola, the World Health Organization is supporting the 9 countries that border the Democratic Republic of the Congo to scale up their national emergency preparedness and response capacities. These countries are Angola, Burundi, the Central African Republic, the Republic of the Congo, Rwanda, South Sudan, Tanzania, Uganda, and Zambia. The World Health Organization's recommendations are meant to ensure that the countries are operationally ready to prevent the importation of cases, implement risk mitigation, detection, and response measures for Ebola. And our colleagues at the UN Migrants Agency, IOM, are assisting survivors from a boat that capsized off the coast of Yemen. At least 100 Ethiopian migrants were crammed into a boat that left from Somalia on Tuesday and was headed to the Gulf countries when it got hit with a high wave. IOM says that 46 people drowned and 16 remain missing. IOM is providing medical assistance, health, food, and psychosocial support for the survivors. And an update on Guatemala, where colleagues from the humanitarian coordination team have assessed the needs in shelters near the south center city of Escuintla, the most affected area by the massive eruption of El Fuego. The team is assisting the government in the humanitarian response, providing psychosocial support, hygiene kits, mattresses, and blankets, among other provisions. And a couple of questions I was asked offline, one on the Ukraine. And the Secretary General's response to the PRST adopted yesterday, and I can say the Secretary General welcomes yesterday's presidential statement adopted in the Security Council on the situation in eastern Ukraine. He fully shares the concerns expressed by the Security Council about the deterioration of the security situation in eastern Ukraine and the need to do more to alleviate the suffering of the civilian population. This needs to be all the more important and urgent, as highlighted by the recent shelling of Donetsk filter station, which has been rendered temporarily inoperative. The Secretary General reiterates the determination of the UN to continue with all the efforts to address deteriorating humanitarian situation in Ukraine, in eastern Ukraine, and urges greater humanitarian access to support the Humanitarian Response Plan of 2018, which remains severely underfunded. The Secretary General also joins the Security Council's call to all parties to commit to the peace process and to do their utmost to achieve progress in the implementation of the Minsk Agreement. And I was also asked earlier about Ethiopia's stated decision to implement the Algiers Peace Agreement. And I can say that the Secretary General was pleased to hear the statement by the Executive Committee of the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front, indicating Ethiopia's decision to implement the Algiers Peace Agreement signed between the two countries in 2000, and the subsequent decisions by the Eritrea-Ethiopia Boundary Commission on the border between the two countries. We reiterate the UN's readiness to play a role in taking the decision forward, including by assisting the parties in the implementation of the border ruling as envisaged in the peace agreement. We look forward to receiving additional information on the way forward. Our monthly food price index report. Global agricultural food commodities prices rose in May, with dairy prices jumping significantly. That's according to the FAO's price index, which is up 1.2% from April. The increase built on a recent trend featuring rising price quotations of major cereals and dairy products and weak ones for sugar and vegetable oils. The FAO has increased its forecast for the world cereal production for 2018. More information online. And our friends at UNICEF today launched a new parenting site as part of their Super Dads campaign, recognizing fathers' role in their children's early development. The online site will bring together fathers from across the world to share their parenting tips, their struggles, their needs, and their successes. UNICEF is calling for more support for fathers globally, including for policies that give parents the time and resources needed to spend quality time with their children. And as Father's Day celebrated across nearly 90 countries this month, UNICEF renews its call to break down cultural, financial barriers preventing fathers from spending quality time with young children. And today we have reached the temperature of 103 because Nauru has joined the honor roll, having paid its dues in full. And I will stop there. Yes.
Thank you, Stefan. I want to ask about the water crisis in Iraq. Turkey started holding back water on the Tigris River. causing further water shortage in Iraq, as nearly 70% of Iraq's need of water is coming from Tigris and Euphrates, those two rivers, which are coming from Turkey. What's the U.S. position about
this? Sure, we're very much aware of the communications between the government of Turkey and Iraq regarding the new Ilusu Dam that Turkey is building on the Tigris River. The U.N. office in Iraq hopes that the government of Iraq and Turkey can resolve the matter through dialogue.
Thank you.
Mr. Roth.
The 103 temperature reading is sometimes what it's like in our offices here in the summer. But moving on.
Take your tie off, Richard. You'll feel more comfortable.
I don't want to embarrass anyone. The UN envoy in Yemen, or for Yemen, Martin Griffiths, is making the rounds. We know he's coming to the council mid-month. Can you comment on a Reuters report that he has a so-called peace plan, which includes the Houthis giving up heavy ballistic missiles in return for an end to the Saudi bombing campaign with a transitional government agreement? Anything on the paper, on the table like this that you, I know it would be difficult for you to confirm in toto? Can you give us an outline of something?
In toto? I'll do
We're
it.
Not in Kansas, though, so please, you, this is New York, you can be honest.
Yes. Okay, sorry. No, we've seen the report. We're not going to comment on the veracity of a document that may or may not have been leaked. Mr. Griffiths has been making the rounds in Yemen and in the region in preparation for his presentation to the Security Council next week, I think on the 18th or the 19th. And I think at that time he will be ready to share where he thinks, where he feels the situation is, but he is making great efforts in trying to get the parties to reach a political agreement to put an end to this conflict in Yemen, which has caused suffering for so many people in the country. Oleg, and then Matthew.
Thanks, Stefan. Staying on Yemen, I believe the meeting on Yemen is going to be in a week, so in the council. And I'm sure you've seen the reports from MSF that they're pulling stuff out of Yemen. I believe it's like more than 70 people. And this, they say it would have a crippling effect on the operations in Yemen. What is the UN right now doing in light of possible offensive?
I'm not aware of any changes in our staffing on the ground. As always, you know, our colleagues that operate in Yemen do so under very difficult circumstances. The security is analyzed on day-to-day, but I'm not aware of any changes. But obviously, any loss of humanitarian staff creates even greater challenges to the ones that already exist.
Taking into account the scale of the operation MSF is doing in Yemen, is the UN prepared to somehow substitute what
they're
doing?
Look, I'm not. I don't have the operational details of what MSF is doing in Yemen, but I don't think we're in a position to take over the work that our partners are doing on the ground. And you know, the vast majority of the work, of humanitarian work done in Yemen, is done in fact by Yemeni nationals. Yep.
Thank you, Stefan. I'd like to ask about this memorandum of understanding the UN has reached with the government of Myanmar. I was wondering if there is a timeline for this agreement to be implemented for the safe, dignified, and voluntary return of the Rohingya refugees. Thank you.
No, there is no. I'm not aware of any timeline. I think, as we said yesterday, the conditions don't exist as of for that return. Don't exist as of yet. You know, the agreement was negotiated between with UNHCR, UNDP, and the government of Myanmar. Our colleagues in Myanmar are continuing to engage communities in designing the activities implemented under the agreement and provide independent information to refugees about the conditions on the ground in order to inform them their return decision. Basically, the decision to return belongs to the individual. No one should be or can be forced to return. It's about us working with the government of Myanmar to ensure that the conditions for safe and dignified and voluntary return exist. But the assessment of those conditions at the end will have to be made by individuals. Yes, sir, and then Matthew. And then
bonjour, monsieur. Stefan, this is Deepak Arora from the Tribune Online. There have been reports of a mysterious illness striking American diplomats in Guangzhou in southern China. And there have been also reports of Canadian and U.S. diplomats experiencing the similar sonic attacks in Cuba. So what has been the response of the Secretary General on this, and has he directed WHO to work on this mysterious...
I've seen the press reports. It is not something that we're involved in any way. Yes, ma'am.
Sure, I want to ask a follow-up on Yemen and something on UNHCR, or the Secretary General said otherwise. In terms of Yemen, just in terms of Martin Griffiths and his plans, it seems like The Norwegian Refugee Council has called on the Saudi-led coalition to investigate a bomb that fell right next to its facility in Sana'a on the 5th of June. And I'm just wondering, one, does the UN, is Mr. Griffiths or whoever here in the Secretariat is looking at this, are they satisfied with the way in which the Saudi-led coalition has investigated and acted on in the falling of its bombs? And what's the status of the Children in Armed Conflict report, which would seem to, I know that last year they were upgraded in terms of their attempts to minimize civilian casualties, and it looks like NRC is saying these steps are not
The report should be out soon. The report will be looking at the year of 2017, right? But it'll be sent to the council probably not next couple of weeks, not too long from now. We have been continuously concerned with the civilian death toll, the attacks on civilians, the attack on civilian infrastructure, and we have repeatedly called on the coalition and other parties to fully investigate those incidents. Your next question.
Sure. I wondered, yesterday you'd said, in terms of this settlement of retaliation claims by Ms. Hunt Mathis, you directed me to read their joint statement. Mm-hmm. So I've read it. But I also note that, and this is why I'm coming back to you with this, she's barred from speaking beyond this joint statement as a condition of her settlement. And I'm wondering, first, does the Secretary General think on issues having to do with alleged retaliation for wanting to investigate rape, is it appropriate to put a gag order on a UN person? And also, she did somehow manage, and I'm not sure it's published, so here's her quote beyond what they did jointly. She said, "The UN justice system needs to be placed entirely outside the purview of the UN, which cannot be at the same time party and judge." So that seems to be something on which the Secretary General should have a response. It's about the system as a whole.
The system of the administration of justice in UN was reformed a few years ago. Its judges are independent. The Secretary General has no say in how the judges do their work. The administration represents itself in front of the tribunals, and staff do too. And sometimes rulings go against the administration. Sometimes they go for the administration.
What about this gag order issue?
I'm not going to comment on the specifics of the case, of which I'm not aware. Evelyn, and then Linda, I think you had a question, then back to Oleg.
Yeah, Amnesty International had an item today on raids into villages in Mozambique by al-Shabaab, probably not related to Somalia. I just wondered if, and people, villagers killed quite frequently.
I wonder
if you had a report on that.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen the Amnesty International report. It's something that's very much on our radar, and something that we're very much concerned about, this violence. Linda.
Thank you, Steph. Regarding the Syrian political process, you mentioned that the UN envoy is in Istanbul, or was in Istanbul to meet with Syrian opposition leaders, and that there would be other meetings in the region. I was just wondering if you can share with us where else the meetings will be taking place. And with
As soon as we get updates from him, we'll share them with you. But he regularly travels around the region. But I'll see if I can get a bit more detail. Oleg, and then we'll come back.
On Syria, with this announcement on the consultations by the special envoy, does this mean we're coming closer to resumption of negotiations?
Look, I think we've been at this for quite some time. It's a process, I think, that's frustratingly slow, not least for the people of Syria. We're taking it step by step. Yeah, go ahead.
On Ukraine, given this lack of funds, this was discussed a lot in the council meetings elsewhere. The UN has a practice of convening donor pledging conferences. Mm-hmm. Maybe this could be the case in the case of Ukraine.
Possibly. Yes, let me see. That's a good valid point. Richard.
It's summer, but this question symbolically has some weight to it, though it doesn't compare to some of the other topics. And people say the UN is behind the times. I can't remember how long it's been, but when thousands walk into the UN lobby, the clock on the wall is an hour behind or completely off. And maybe we discussed this months ago. I can't remember, and maybe it's officially broken. But
which clock?
The on the wall
in the visitors' lobby.
The elevators. Yeah, no, in the secretariat lobby.
Okay. Well, and let me see what the if I can move the clock even further back.
Time stands still here, but not that bad.
Yes, I know. At least hopefully the year's right. Evelyn, then Matthew.
On Ethiopia, Eritrea, the UN, is there a peacekeeping force envisioned? Any details? Because the UN has seen
this
movie
before.
No, the UN
was present in Ethiopia, Eritrea for a long time. The mission closed.
I remember.
We were also involved in the border commission. As I said, we're willing to help the parties as much as possible. Matthew, then Linda.
Is there anything planned?
No, as I said, we're looking forward to hearing more details.
Go ahead,
sure.
Matthew, go ahead. Okay, I wanted to ask you this. It has to do with Cameroon. It's reported that, and it's reported, it's identified Samuel Eto'o, the football player, as a UN goodwill ambassador, and it's said that he will be touring with government officials, the Anglophone areas, trying to encourage people to either go back to school or stop protesting. And so there's a lot of pushback against it, and I wanted to know, one, when's the last time Mr. Fall was in the area? Maybe you have it or could find it.
There's nothing more than what is publicly known.
Is this number – would Samuel Eto'o's trip, if it takes place, he's in Yaoundé, would it be as a UN goodwill ambassador? And if so, what would you say to
I have to check what his status is and who he
actually
works
for. What people are saying is that he said nothing about this crisis the whole time.
I'm not debating it. I just have to see what the details are.
I'd appreciate an answer on that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Linda.
Thank you, Steph. I believe there was a meeting last evening between the Secretary General and various Arab and other ambassadors, and I was wondering if you could share some information.
No, there's no read. I was on the broad Middle East situation, but nothing to share.
What about the meeting with the Africa Group today? Is that about budget issues?
No,
is it about
personnel? I'll try to get some details. Thank you. Brendan, all yours.
That was the spokesperson for the UN Secretary General, Stephane Dujarric, at the UN headquarters on Thursday, doing his daily press briefing. On Thursday, Russia's President Vladimir Putin held a marathon 4-hour teleconference with constituents from around the Russian Federation and members of the assembled press and various government agencies. RT's Murad Gazdiev has more.
Well, it's difficult to sum up 4 hours and 20 minutes of questions and answers, but some of the things that really stood out was what Vladimir Putin had to say about foreign affairs. And here, for example, Vladimir Putin recently presented a slew of super weapons. We're talking here about bigger, more powerful, faster nuclear missiles, ballistic missiles, as well as hypersonic missiles, which travel at 6-7 kilometers a second through the atmosphere, about nuclear-powered missiles. And one viewer challenged Vladimir Putin, saying, you know, does this stuff really exist?
There are those who doubt new Russian weapons are soon going to be put into service. Back in 2004, they were doubting the avant-garde system. But now we see it in Syria. And that's not everything that we're planning to produce and put into service. As I said in my address, it's too early to talk about it, but we will speak out soon.
The president stressed that this isn't about saber rattling or waving your guns around or, you know, measuring anything with anyone. But this is about parity. This is about making sure that Russia has a deterrent, that no enemy, no potential opponent can overcome Russia. And here, another particularly worried viewer asked Vladimir Putin how close we are to World War III.
You know, you can recall Einstein's words. He said, I don't know with what weapons World War III will be fought, but World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones. The understanding of the fact that World War III may be the end of modern civilization must deter us from extreme actions on the international scene.
All this war talk and fears is no surprise, given current tensions between the East and the West, between Russia and the United States and its allies. And people ask, you know, when is this going to end? When is this division going to end, these sanctions, these restrictions? And Vladimir Putin said that they won't until we all treat each other as equals, until nations learn to respect each other and to compromise, to understand that there are differences and various countries have various interests. He pointed out Europe, where he says winds are changing. There is now open talk of lifting sanctions against Russia. Vladimir Putin stressed that, you know, sanctions and restrictions, they've never served anyone. They always come back to bite whoever put them in place. And he pointed to the trade war that has just erupted between Europe and the United States, saying that the new tariffs that Washington has slapped on the Europeans, which have made them very unhappy, those aren't so much tariffs as they are sanctions.
One of the French government's ministers recently said that the U.S. shouldn't be allowed to become the economic policeman of the world, and he spoke about it publicly. The former German minister of finance publicly said that Germany hasn't been a fully sovereign state since 1945. Everybody can see what's going on, but probably our partners thought it would never affect them. That kind of politics is counterproductive, a politics of limitations and sanctions.
Now, that was what Vladimir Putin had to say about foreign policy. Obviously, most of what was talked about in this Q&A session was domestic affairs, domestic things, things that worry Russians, such as salary, taxes, healthcare, education, corruption, always a big one. But Vladimir Putin also spoke about the upcoming World Cup, due to kick off in about a week in all over Russia, really. And he said that the Russian team lately hasn't played as well, perhaps, as some would expect. And he said he hoped that now that the World Cup is here, they'll really show what they've got.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello, we're here in St. Petersburg attending the annual St. Petersburg International Economic Forum. Our topic is from the Atlantic to the Pacific. We all know the world is changing. We talk about what moves these changes and who's behind them. Welcome to our panel titled From the Atlantic to the Pacific, Creating a Space for Trust. Trust in 2018. That's an interesting concept here. Before we start our discussion, I'd like to ask each one of my guests to introduce themselves and their affiliations. Antonio, go ahead.
I am Antonio Falico from Italy, Banca Intesa.
Jean-Pierre Thomas, I was a representative of the French president for economic cooperation at the time of President Sarkozy, and member of Lazard, like MD, for 15 years. And after, I am president of my own company, in advising European big companies who invest and work in Russia.
Excellent.
Okay. I'm Alexei Chekunkov, Chief Executive Officer of the Government Far East and Baikal Region Development Fund.
I'm Klaus Mangold. I have been for 10 years the chairman of the German Association for Central Eastern Europe, and I have different responsibilities in boards of major companies, as for example TUI, Alstom, as well as Rothschild.
Alexei Pushkov, chairman of the Information and Media Commission of the Upper Chamber of the Russian Parliament.
Philippe?
Philippe Gorier, I'm the president of company Alstom in Russia. So Alstom producing rolling stock and solutions for the railways. And I'm also the vice chairman of the Association of European Businesses in Russia.
And last but not least.
And my name is Sergei Karaganov, and I am a dean of the faculty or school of international economics and foreign affairs at the State at the Research University Higher School of Economics.
We always have these long descriptions for these panels, okay? But I think the title, you know, creating a space for trust, I mean, are we even at a point where we can even contemplate creating trust when we have so much distrust that is just only enhancing as time goes by? And it's particularly, well, one particular country in the world is sowing a lot of distrust all across the globe. And we can talk about the Iran deal and other things, but I mean, you know, this was written before that happened. But can we actually talk about trust right now? Are we even close to that?
To my mind, trust is based on a certain balance of interests. And until we reach those balance of interests, trust will be in jeopardy. That's evident. Asserting one's interest, the interest of one country over the interests of other countries by means of pressure, sanctions, and so on, that is destroying trust. And that's why I understand the essence of your question. If we talk about trust today, what are we facing? I think we are facing an effort at trust destruction. To my mind, it comes mostly from one global power, and the only global power, that has engaged itself on the path of America First, which means that the interests of the United States are coming in first place, despite any balance of interests, contrary to the necessity of having trust being rebuilt in the world.
Sergei, I think, you know, mentioning the term interest, I mean, there's nothing wrong with sovereign countries protecting their national interests. It's universal. But in this day and age, we have some that would say your interests are not legitimate.
Basically, I think that they trying to build their relationship, I mean, between states, on trust is a failed exercise, as well as the failed exercise was to build relations between states based on values, because values are changing within states, within societies constantly, and you couldn't even find the base. You could build a relationship upon common interests and balance of power. And that is the only foundation for whatever you call trust. If you understand that your interests coincide or concur, or they're moving in the same directions, then you could work together. Working together, you could build up a relationship which you call trust. But if there is no solid foundation, then we are doomed to fail. That has happened exactly, I mean, 20 years ago, when we were talking trust, 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 while one side was, I mean, pushing another side, I mean, to the fringe of, political extinction. Now we have a backlash. If, for example, a 15, and due to that backlash, we have a one-sided Cold War. And according to some of the calculations of me and my colleagues, we, Russia plus China and others, could win in this Cold War. Will it be good for us? No, because the balance will be, again, not stable.
Yes, because going into like a new Cold War, ice war, is not with the choice of all parties here. Mm. Antonio, you wanted to make a comment.
May I surprise you? I would like to focus on free trade. We often believe that there are things which are to stay with us forever. Then we are shocked when we discover that something has disappeared. Free trade seemed to be eternal, but in fact it is now evaporating. The original idea was to eliminate barriers for goods and the capital flows. Today we wake up and discover that the global economy is leaning toward protectionism. Examples are plenty. The US introduced a global restriction on imports of steel and aluminium while bargaining for exemptions out of self-interest.
We got your point about free trade here, and let me go to Jean-Pierre because I think it's really important. If we look at a greater Eurasian political and economic space, obviously trade is going to be involved in that. Do you think recent events, again, Iran is the 800-pound gorilla sitting in the corner, is this sending a very strong message now that the Europeans have to start looking towards it? I mean, it's a truism. Asia is the center of the future, okay, because of economic trade, because of populations, all kinds of things. But, I mean, real political events on the ground now should make the Europeans start rethinking their position vis-a-vis the Atlantic world.
Yeah, to make the link with the previous question and this one, you know, the trust is a nice thing, but it depends. We need rules of the game, of the rule of the game change. We are not in a unilateral world. You know, Russia is back, China is there, not only the United States, but Europe is not back. Now, these sanctions imposed by the U.S. and the last volley of the sanctions have not to be applicated to European companies. And I think the historical opportunity is for Europe now, and I think that our Italian partners in Europe are on that way, that we have the opportunity to stop when there's a sanctions. Everybody forgets that every 6 months,
right,
Europe has to renew the sanctions or not. And the rule is unanimity.
Jean-Pierre, but, you know, agreed. But, I mean, the Europeans have not shown a lot of strength, let's put it that way, okay? Let's go back to 2003 and the illegal invasion of Iraq. I mean, sure, France and Germany they didn't back it, but in the end, they went along with it.
Right.
Okay, I mean, is this a turning point here?
It's
because I hear this from Europeans all the time. But nothing changes, okay?
But you know what is my point of view? That it's very dangerous for Europe. Because if we continue like this, first we go against our interests, which is bad for our companies. A lot of European companies are here. It's bad for our population, but it's bad for Europe. Because some countries, you know, Italy's example, will go out of this agreement generally in Europe. So Europe can explode one day if we not solve this problem. I think the President Macron has an historical opportunity, you know, in the goalist way, to say stop.
Klaus, let me go to you, because I think it's really interesting. I mean, if we look at a greater Eurasia, a political, economic, and trade space, is this a duplication of Western institutions that were put into place after the Second World War? I'm thinking of the IMF, Bretton Woods, these kinds of institutions here. I mean, there's a interesting literature about the world beyond the West, or parallel to the West. Is this something you would see? Because there is a hegemon in the West. It's the United States. But if we look at the Eurasian space, would there be a hegemon? Would it be actually more democratic in a way? Go ahead.
I would like to come back to two points. I believe that the question of confidence and trust is something where we should be, I believe, quite objective and say the world has changed. The world has changed, and I believe that when we are thinking and coming back to what we have seen as a basis in the world where we had a strong confidence between us, I believe this has changed dramatically. I believe that at the end of the day, Europe has to take in a very short time frame a major decision about for what it stands for. Is this a Europe of 27? Is this a Europe between France, Germany, Italy, Spain, and a few others? Or what will be the future of Europe? And this leads as well to the question if we can see some parallelities between what we have achieved in Europe, in other organizations in this world. And I believe that Asia has a huge chance as well to develop something which is bringing more nations together than up to now. And there are very interesting developments, not so much about democracy. I believe this is something we should put on the side for a certain
Agreed.
Time. I believe if you are looking to a state as Kazakhstan or Uzbekistan, these are countries who are developing in a certain sense and who have a parliament, but they are coming from a long-term history which doesn't allow to think and to work in categories of democratic countries. And I believe that Uzbekistan, with a strong tradition in manufacturing, could be a very good complementarity for both of the countries. And so let them give some time, help, subsidies, monies with the EBRD to develop these economies, and I believe this will be well-invested money.
Okay, let me go to Alexa, because I mean, it's interesting you're talking about Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan. I mean, Kazakhstan's a very interesting story and very interesting model. Yes. But when we think of the Eurasia space, everyone more or less thinks, to what degree, and I go to Alexa here, does China lead?
Well, China does indeed pretend now to be leading since the famous speech by Xi Jinping in Davos, where he filled the vacuum left by the superpower on the other side of the Atlantic. But I would like to quickly come back to your question of trust and bring up one fact. As an investor and part of the group of my profession, where people having our own crystal balls, looking into the future, having our models, analyzing corporations, companies, how to preserve wealth and purchasing power for decades ahead. Investors do not nearly feel the same crisis, do not display any gloom. If you look at financial markets, bond yields are very low. Equity valuations are very high. So investors are happy. Companies are investing at record levels. Banks, who recently were sort of written off as a non-existent profession, are turning out 10% return on equity on trillions of assets. So financial markets are doing well. So I frankly think that a lot of this trust crisis is more of a political phenomenon, where politicians use rhetorics addressing their domestic audiences.
Well, using the weapon of sanctions is more than rhetorics.
I agree.
It's very serious. And it's a form of warfare that I think is people underestimate a lot, okay? I mean, when you think how many countries in the world are under sanction by the United States, it's extraordinary. It's extraordinary.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
I'm Peter Lavelle. I'm host of RT's political discussion program, Crosstalk, and we have a very interesting panel here to discuss this issue of trust. Let me go to Philippe here.
I'm a businessman, so I will give a more business point of view. It's clear there is no business without trust. For us, what is important in this, there is unions. There is EU. There's the Eurasian Economic Union. For us, we want more integration with European businessmen, more integration between these two unions. Why? And why a lot of them, but China? I will tell you, it's very fair. The 70% in Russia, 70% and so quite more or less in the Russian Economic Union, 70% of the foreign direct investment are European. That's all. 10% American and the rest others. Yeah. And China is... In terms of investment, it's not a lot. Because we produce, it means that the European companies produce here, produce in Russia, produce in Kazakhstan, produce in the Union, that we have companies, we manage these companies. These companies are against, of course, the Russian or the Eurasian Economic Union law, but we manage them. And we have no problem. We have kept the trust of the Russian authorities, of the Commission of the Eurasian Economic Union, and so on. So we are here, and we don't want to go. Well, it's one of the largest countries.
What
the
I can say is you would never read that in the New York Times here. Let me go to our front row here, and then we'll just completely open it up to everyone here.
Thank you, Peter. But the discussion so far has avoided the theme from Atlantic to Pacific. I just want to read that point.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I want to pick up on this idea of a parallel world of business and transactions, and I think that's a very valid idea. Things have become different from the Cold War times. We don't have a classic Cold War. We have a confrontation between, at the top level, between the governments, and still a lot of context, a lot of interaction, a lot of meetings, and so on, between the societies. And that's a qualitatively new feature, and it also applies to business, because we have a Cold War, or an appearance of a Cold War, but the businesses are still doing well. There is the issue of sanctions, which is extremely important and which actually spoils a bit this picture of a parallel world which is independent of politics. I've been speaking to quite a few people in the European Union at the very top level,
And I say, are you against sanctions? Yes, we are very much against sanctions. So please say it at the Council of the European Union. Say, well, maybe if the Italians do that, we will support them. Then I talk to the Italians. They say, well, if the Spanish do that, we will support them. I say, I come to Athens, and I say, look, but tell it, please, you are against the sanctions against Russia. Yeah, they tell you, you are Greece, you can afford your Orthodox, you know.
Yeah, but that's individuals, but as a group, they can't say no.
And so Merkel, when she decides what to do in order to keep the unity of the European Union, she says,
a country that's leaving the European Union, wonderful.
Let's renew the sanctions every 6 months without discussing this issue, because it will be yet another issue of discord in the European Union.
But the problem is that, you know, we have something which is a key point, and we didn't speak about it. You say that the people are, if you speak with the top political level guys, you are right. And if you speak totally right, but some people say what I say, I belong to them. But, you know, for the business community, the top CEO of the big group, what happens? If they have subsidiary in the United States, they are like this. They cannot sign nothing.
Exactly.
Because they are blocked, and when they not even can go again to New York or Washington, the United States. And their compliance system blocked them. And the legal opinion, who does the legal opinion? Our American friends.
No, what a way
so
to
the system is blocked. So we have to stop the extraterritoriality of the law of US in Europe and have the counterparty. If not, you are blocked.
That's no way to treat allies and friends.
That's the key point.
Let me go to Sergei here.
That's the key point.
Unfortunately, you know, to lift sanctions, you need more than one country. That's the rule of the EU Union.
Yeah.
But I want to return back to the Atlantic, to the Pacific. We are all from Europe here in this jungle. We have to understand that we bitterly failed 25 years ago when we had an opportunity to build a common space. But one of the reasons why we failed was because we didn't have a common goal. And now Russia and other countries are proposing us a new common goal of building a greater Eurasia space, including Japan, including eventually Indonesia. We are having a new opportunity. We have to think differently. And maybe if we go in that direction together, we will rebuild the foundation for trust. And not building it, of course, against Chinese, because I've been recently to Germany. I mean, you all remember. I mean, and some of our German friends, I mean, let's unite against China. Haha, no way. I mean, let's unite with China.
2 points. The first point is about what you have said. Many people in Europe have today the feeling, what you were just mentioning, that Russia is moving east and less committed to Western European orientations, which would be, I believe, a shift of paradigm.
Yes.
And it could be a development which still will be a new wake of distinction between Western Europe, the EU, and Russia. And I believe that we must be very careful if we say that we have a common history, that we have common values between Russia and Western Europe, not talking so much about the EU, but about Western Europe especially. I believe that this should be a point which triggers again then the question of trust and of confidence. And, you know, it's for us, especially as coming from a German point of view, we have so much common links between Russia and Germany, history, literature, this terrible war, being grateful for what you have done for our reunification and whatever. So we believe that we would not like to give this up. We would like to be close to Russia.
If I remember Klaus' statement here on the same subject 5 years ago, he would have said, oh, no, Russia is a completely European and you shouldn't even go east or think east. Now, you're already ambivalent about that weather. I mean, Klaus, in 5 years, and then you will say that let's go together. because you are extremely wise, you are extremely far-reaching, you are extremely strategic. Nope. You're one of the few strategic Germans I know.
Sergei,
and that will happen.
Sergei, we know each other now since more than 25 years.
Yeah.
And I believe really that what I wanted to say is that we must have in Europe, together with Russia, a very clear strategic orientation where to go. And exactly. I believe this is even more important after the Iran decision of the United
States.
Absolutely.
And
agreed.
This is something I believe where we have to work and where should we should have as well a new basis of confidence. And we should bring out these doubts which we have actually about the strategy of Russia.
Very important whether Europe will pass the test of Iran. Because everybody says, let's keep the deal. Now, Merkel has agreed that European companies will leave Iran mostly, and the European Union will not compensate to Iran the losses.
You know,
so if Europe is dragged into the U.S. sanctions against Iran against its own will, then the test will not be passed.
No, sorry, you know, I think it's
Mr. Peskov is absolutely
exactly
right. How I would say to my German friend, how we can ask to our German friends, we want to be sure if you want to go more east and west. We do everything to push them in the arms of China.
Yes.
And we are lucky that they are not completely in this end of China because they try to do their best for many years.
Europeans never can agree.
So. That's European debate.
Second, I would like to say,
that's
the US. The US is very easy, you know. It's the biggest market in the world. So for a company, it's very... I am in Iran, as I'm in the US. If there is sanctions, where I close? I prefer to close Iran. I prefer to close US. Of course, not US. You see, after what is your interest. If you have more trade, more investment in Iran, but usually you have more in the US. So it's very easy.
Let's go to the front row here.
So far, by hearing this very lively discussion and debate, I just want to make the following point. First of all, I think there are China-Russia economically are quite complementary. China has a surplus of capacity in building infrastructure. Maybe we are overdoing that in China, but China is good at doing that. Ideology aside, I think China sees that as a precondition for economic development. Secondly, China is taking environment protection now extremely seriously, again, because we have overlooked that for so many years, we are paying the price. So Russia has competitive advantage on that front. I think Central Asia is extremely important. I don't want to de-emphasize that. But I think Central Asia itself won't move the needle when you look at Pacific, when you look at Europe. So economically, I do see the rationale for China, Russia, and Germany not to form alliance, but to create more synergy economically. This is a Chinese leaders' perspective, precisely because these two French gentlemen have been arguing against each other. Chinese leaders, I think, they only take Germany seriously in Europe. I hate to say this.
I believe, really, Germany has a strong interest, a very strong interest. I can say it again, due to tradition, due to history, due to a lot of common links, that we should come back to a leadership role in Europe to bring Russia back in a Western orientation. We have no interest at all that Russia is moving east. This is not in our interest.
But you have this to, is not you in have our, to choose then.
Yes,
you
yes,
have to choose. You,
yes,
you can't stay
yes, but
in
as well,
NATO
we have
and
to
make that strategic
but you know,
decision. You can't.
But Peter, the life is not black and white. I believe really...
Oh, I think there's a
yes,
man in the White House
yes,
thinks
yes, but,
differently.
But,
okay.
But, certainly. But I believe that we have to make sure that we are doing as well a lot of efforts as Europeans, especially since the United States development, that we are doing everything to bring the sanctions down. And Sergei knows my opinion about this.
Yeah, because you think the litmus test is going to be your energy policy? Because
yes.
You know what?
Yeah.
Europe's energy
yes.
policy is being made in Washington, D.C. right now.
Yes.
And it's
yeah,
up to
totally,
Germany
totally.
To make
as
that
well,
decision.
As well, this is not black and white. You will see that we will find a solution for Nord Stream 2 in the next couple of weeks. And knowing that the Americans
you heard
don't...
it here, guys. You heard
and,
it here.
And,
okay.
And knowing that the Americans will not like it, and that they will certainly look for other ways and means to bring discipline back between the United States and Germany and the EU. So I believe this is what we have to be aware of. But I'm sure that we have, as well as Germans, very strongly looking to the United States, that we see that there is something changing if it comes to the overall, let me say, excellent relationship which we always had between Germany, Europe, and the United States. Iran is a critical point,
yeah,
a very critical point. And the issue that the United States were taking a decision against, not without, but against a European very clear orientation will be with some harm for the next foreseeable future.
All right, we've run out of time. I hope you've enjoyed our panel here from the Atlantic to the Pacific, creating a space for trust here at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum. Thank you for being with us.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.